Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Did you know that Xavi Hernandez used to scan over 8 times in the 10 seconds before receiving the ball? It's therefore not surprising that he rarely lost it. Scientific studies have shown just how important scanning is in soccer. Players who scan more, for example, make twice as many successful forward passes than those who scan less. But training this skill is difficult. And that's why thousands of players trust Be Your Best, the soccer training app in virtual reality, designed to improve players' game intelligence. To learn more, visit beyourbest.com and use code POD20 to get 20% off your first subscription.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Seb Stafford-Bloor from Tifo Football, and Adrian Clark, the tactical analyst. Stop me if you've heard this before. Jose Mourinho is beyond reproach. He's been let down by his players. Doubt him, and you're free to count his medals. Now, I'm not disrespecting his record. Trophies lace his CV. But that was then. This is now. 7 months into the job at Spurs, he's winning few friends. I recognise this is a difficult question for you, Seb, because you're emotionally invested in the club. But has he already outstayed his welcome?
That's probably a little strong. I mean, you say I'm emotionally invested. I think the most damaging effect of this little spell has been, from a personal standpoint, I've become emotionally uninvested. Because it all feels so familiar for the reasons you've just listed. We've got declining performances, a lot of excuses, players taking the blame, every department of the side deteriorating at the moment. There isn't a single area of the team at Spurs which has improved since Jose Mourinho arrived. At the same time, I hear people who question his job security. The two things to say about that are, first, well, he's staying because it's just too expensive to sack him. The second is, it's too early as well, because I don't think the blame for this situation lies with Jose Mourinho. I think you have to look at what Tottenham are. I think you have to look at the, examine the basis by which they made this decision. You know, how was it that a squad that had been put together to suit Mauricio Pochettino was then deemed to be suited to Jose Mourinho's management? It's absolutely ridiculous. I think the outcome of this is not to question what Jose Mourinho is, because we know all of these things. We know about the second and third act in his career. We know how far away from that original European Cup winning character he is now. The question to ask is, what were the processes by which he arrived at the club? Why is Daniel Levy making sporting decisions? This has to be the conclusion. This has to be the point at which people say, if you want to be a grown-up football club, you have to have the grown-up football structure. And I think that's my frustration. I think the question is, why is this all so predictable? So when Jose Mourinho walked through the door, we knew he would alienate people. We knew that certain players would be victims of his approach. In this instance, it's been the club's record signing. Why is it that nobody within the club saw this coming? Now, it's almost worth posing that question to Adrian, you know, before me, because I feel like I'm too frustrated by it to be clear-headed. I'm too annoyed to be rational. But this seems to be the case. I still, you know, all these months later, I still haven't heard a justification for why Jose Mourinho was given this job ahead of anybody else. Why was it imperative not just to appoint him, but to pay him that amount of money to be in this position? This is not an appointment that was based on merit. Please, someone correct me.
Yeah, you know, it strikes me that we're almost in a sort of a West Ham type scenario here. You've got a club which was bold enough and brave enough to, you know, spend £1 billion of other people's money on a fantastic stadium. You've got, basically, in employing Mourinho, you've got a manager who I think fundamentally misunderstands the importance of a club's culture and identity, and basically because he's too consumed with his own identity. Is that, am I being fair there, Aid?
I don't think Jose Mourinho gives a hoot about a club's identity, you know, or, you know, past, particularly the culture, so to speak. He just is himself, isn't he? I think that Seb makes some really good points, definitely in regards to Daniel Levy making this call and not someone with what you'd regard as football expertise or experienced football expertise. It was an appointment, wasn't it, that basically ripped up the plan and of building through Pochettino, a young coach. I think he was right to go. I think his energy levels had kind of vanished, Pochettino, and I do think a change was necessary. But to rip it up and basically go for Mourinho was a sign of panic, actually, in my opinion. We just want to win. It doesn't really matter how we win anymore. We just need to get a trophy now, because that's what Jose Mourinho does, or at least that's what Daniel Levy thought when he appointed him. I think he disregarded or buried his head in the sand in regards to what he brings to the table, the animosity, the friction, the bad rep for the club, because he will always cause problems in the media, alienating players. Yeah, it's disappointing. Looking at it from a purely football perspective, I go back to something Seb mentioned. Who has he improved? Which players have got better under Jose Mourinho? I don't think I've got enough hands on both fingers to list the players that have gone backwards, but I don't know who has improved. And that is coaching. And that is, you know, that's supposed to be an elite coach on £15 million a year. I don't think he is what he used to be, unfortunately. And I don't believe that modern players respond to his style of management. And I also think I'm not calling him a dinosaur, but I don't think he has moved with the times, and he struggles against some of these modern thinkers that have emerged as dugout rivals for him. So yeah, look, it was a truly awful appointment. It was made, in my view, simply, we have to win a trophy, and that will fix everything, and it hasn't happened.
Hey, can I just jump in there? Because there's a couple of things that bother me about this. Is that, like, the idea that a chairman of a football club thinks that the route to trophies now lies solely in a managerial appointment is so naive. You do not win anything because of this old school, you know, this messiah type model. A football club is the sum of a football club's parts is really the only thing that matters. How do these departments join up? The technical department, the recruiting department, data analytics. You do not, we are not back in the sort of the late 80s, early 90s, where, you know, maybe you appoint a Sir Alex Ferguson and you have 25 years of decadent success. It just doesn't exist anymore. And if Daniel Levy really thinks, I mean, I hate to say it, but if you examine Daniel Levy's record for appointing managers, it is very poor. He got very fortunate with Mauricio Pochettino. That was an excellent appointment. But I think the product of that spell has been to kind of create the idea that Daniel Levy is the right person to make these decisions. If you look at his back catalogue and you look at the Santinis and the Ramoses, and, you know, I quite liked Andre Villas-Boas, but that didn't work either. And Martin Jol fell into his lap as a result of Santini failing. You know, Redknapp was Redknapp, and, you know, to be honest, you know, the average bloke down the pub could have made that appointment. It's just, it speaks of an incredible naivety. Yeah. Like, it's a kind of, it also, like, I have my own theory about this, and this represents my opinion rather than any, it's not based on anything factual. I've always thought this was made because Mourinho turned Levy down back in 2007. This is a kind of, I can do this now. You know, this is an appointment that I can make. I have the infrastructure and the wealth to put him in charge of my football club, and I'm going to do it whether it's the right thing to do or not. And I absolutely hate that.
Who chooses the players at Spurs, by the way? Who's the
Well, Steve Hitchens, the head scout, has kind of evolved into a kind of more of a director of football role, but it's quite nebulous. I mean, there's not the sort of the definition that you have at a club like Liverpool, for instance. It's more of an Arsenal situation, actually, just without the personnel. It's a kind of decision by committee. So certainly when Pochettino was at the club, he was a voice in that conversation, but not the primary voice. So now I don't know. I don't know what kind of influence Mourinho is going to have on recruitment. I mean, He said, obviously, the January edition of Steven Bergwijn, that wasn't his idea. He's been pleasantly surprised by Bergwijn. So, you know, terrific. But it does suggest that he hasn't come in with a recruiting mandate.
Yeah.
This whole thing is going nowhere good.
I just look at the defence with Alderweireld and Vertonghen sort of ostracised and, you know, various issues going on there. And you just think with Sanchez and Dier, absolute state of their performance against Sheffield United was a shocker, wasn't it? And the attitudes, the recovery runs, just the desire to defend wasn't there. Aurier, we know, can't defend. Even Ben Davies is sort of caught, was catching the problem in the last game. You just wonder whether he can set a team up to defend like he used to be able to. It's a really strange one, because that's one thing you could rely on with Jose. He would organise a team to be hard to beat. Just wonder whether it's down to the players not being good enough or the impact of his coaching.
But, you know, we're talking about team development here. Well, it's not as simple as replacing, you know, a serial underachiever like Aurier, for instance, with a relatively cheap, exceptionally promising player like a Max Aarons or whatever. You know, you look back, we'll talk about Manchester United later, but they could have had Bruno Fernandes. And didn't, because of the money aspects of it, presumably. So, to your point, Seb, you are looking at a club which has become factionalised. And if you're going to have anyone to unite a club, Mourinho is not that man. There are better models out there. You know, we're talking the morning after Southampton defeated Manchester City. And I thought Ralph Hasenhüttl gave a real coaching masterclass against Pep in that game. I thought he was terrific. Okay, you know, if you look at the actual stats of that game, I think City had as many shots in losing to Southampton, which was 25, as Leicester did in beating Southampton 9-0. But the point remains, there are better models out there that Tottenham could and maybe should have had.
I can't argue with any of that. I heard a couple of people on social media equating that Southampton performance to the Spurs game against Man City that they won 2-0. I mean, they're not similar. The Man City performance at White Hart Lane, Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, was just comedic. It was just a comedy of missed chances, missed penalties, bad decisions, Zinchenko getting himself sent off. Whereas in reality, Southampton defended quite well. The thing that worries me, Mike, is you guys touched on it earlier. The thing that Mourinho is supposed to guarantee you is solidity. And the only defensive improvement that I've seen over these last 7 months has come from just stacking players behind the ball. There's been no sort of systemic improvement. There's been no sense that the centre-halves, the full-backs, the defensive midfielders, that they are wedded to any kind of structure. It's a, let's just pack the middle of the pitch and hope for the best, because that's what it's been. It's like that against Manchester City. It was like that against Manchester United. It was like that against Liverpool. And then when the ball gets the other side of the halfway line, no one has any idea what to do with it. It's let's make it up as we go along. It is quite literally like watching a group of players who have had no instruction whatsoever when they have the ball at their feet. And it's ad-libbed. The whole thing is ad-libbed.
Yeah, on that, I'm glad Mike mentioned Bruno Fernandes. You've seen what can happen when you get that link player, a really good player that links the midfield to the attack with quality and with speed. And what Spurs have good forwards. They're very quick forwards. You know, Harry Kane, that's not his key strength, but he's a brilliant finisher. Everyone else is very quick and direct. What they need is that conduit, someone to split the defences on those counters, someone to pick the right pass. And I think Christian Eriksen used to be that guy to some degree, and he was by some distance their best creator. And I look around now and think, who is going to be that person? And yeah, just wonder what the club are thinking in not effectively replacing Eriksen. That is the missing piece in the jigsaw.
From your perspective, Aid, how much blame needs to be attached to the players themselves? You know, do you agree, for instance, I noticed Raphael van der Vaart over the weekend was saying, look, Tottenham have got players who think they're better than they are. And lest we forget, they are probably the same ones who let down Pochettino as well. So how much blame do the players need to accept?
Yeah, look, I thought the performance against Sheffield United was really bad, and I thought the attitude wasn't good. It's not like that every week with Spurs. They, you know, put in some more respectable displays, and the attitude has been okay. I think that in general, footballers respond to the gaffer. Now, they're a little bit sheep-like, footballers, if I'm being honest. You get the odd exception that will be absolutely 100% self-driven and self-motivated all the time, and they'll never lower their standards. But in general, teams respond to the leader, and they are the people that maintain standards and drive up standards. I just look at Spurs right now, and I just see that standards are slipping. And is Jose, the manager, the head coach, is he doing enough about that? That's what I would query right now. So, yeah, look, players have to look at themselves, but you can go back in the history of time. If they are motivated by the person in charge and the general vibe in the dressing room, and if you give them a bit of rope, they'll take it. Footballers, they're strange beasts like that. So yeah, I would still say that it's the head coach's responsibility to get minds and attitudes right.
Well, let's look at Manchester United then. You know, we've talked in the past, haven't we, about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and our doubts about him. Yet they go to Aston Villa on Thursday on a roll. 16 matches unbeaten, 5 goals at Old Trafford in the Premier League for the first time since December 2011. You've got a team flowing. You've got a team which is basically new reputations are being forged almost every match. Now, the reputation that everyone is going to talk about at the moment is Mason Greenwood, youngest Manchester United player to 15 goals since Norman Whiteside. Is he a generational talent, Seb?
Ooh, big tag that, Mike. I'm not sure about that at the moment. I'm just in the enjoying watching him stage. He's so expressive and so direct and so confident. In a way, it's quite encouraging that I don't think that he's a generational talent, because he's just one of so many gifted players. I was actually, before we started, I was doing a little tally of the players of his generation, or so not of his age, but of his kind of age group that England will have the benefit of in over the next sort of decade. It's amazing. I think he is of his generation, but I don't know. I mean, and that's the joy of it, isn't it? I don't know what he's going to turn into yet. I don't know sort of what his long-term position is. I don't know how his abilities are going to mature. He's just, it's so much fun to watch a player of that age be so bold on the ball. Been an absolute joy.
Well, he's better than Cristiano Ronaldo was when he joined Manchester United as a teenager. In my opinion, you think about that.
Not to build him up.
No. I know exactly what I've just done there. But I've
Take
gone against
that, Mason.
You. I do think he's a bit special. I'm prepared to sort of hang my hat on this boy. I think he's very special. Foden level brilliance, really, in my opinion. I think the pair of them could be global stars. I genuinely think that, because they're so good at such a young age, technically, temperament. And you just have to look at the way he strikes a ball. And I think that can make a big difference. He's got the bits of guile, really clever with the way that he disguises his shooting. I think that's a key asset. But the way he strikes the ball with both feet is just incredible. He doesn't have a weakness. And defenders, therefore, they can't show him one way or the other, because he can go right and spank it top corner, and he can do the same on the left. I do think he is exceptional. Look at, talking to the front players, by the way, I've got some stats for you. Well, on Greenwood, 8 Premier League goals from 16 shots on target. That's a phenomenal strike rate. In terms of minutes per goal, Greenwood, 115 minutes per goal. Bruno Fernandes, 128. Martial and Rashford, both 147 minutes per goal. Manchester United have 4 players with a better than 1-in-2 record. Significantly better. That is scary. If they get the rest of their team right, that means they've got the firepower to really compete at the top end of the table. It's you can't hide away those figures. They're Premier League numbers. They're not just in all competitions. They're not skewed by the Europa League. I think that they've got a frighteningly good forward line. And yeah, Greenwood, wow, the potential is huge.
Yeah, I suppose you know, what we're looking at here is a very modern issue, isn't it? That always in the past at Manchester United, they were very good, or specifically Sir Alex Ferguson was very good at shielding a Ryan Giggs or a Beckham from the hype. Now, that was then, and this is now, to repeat myself from earlier on, it's a much more difficult age for a young player to grow up in. And if you think about it, injury could take its toll. You know, I mentioned Norman Whiteside earlier on. There was someone who came in and, you know, was exceptional, and his body let him down. But you've now got the goldfish bowl, which is getting bigger and more transparent and more dangerous, let's be honest. If you're Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, Seb, do you wrap him up in cotton wool?
I don't know that you can, Mike, because, I mean, unlike the Ryan Giggs example is really pertinent, because obviously there was got a book on my shelf which contains Hugh McIlvenny's first interview with Ryan Giggs, which was a big deal because it was the first time that Alex Ferguson had allowed one. In this instance, the dynamic is completely different because players have access to the wider world in a way that they didn't. You don't get to shield someone because they've got their own social media account, they've got their Instagram, they've got their Twitter, they've got their Facebook. So I don't know what Ole Solskjaer can do other than mandating that none of his players can have an online profile, which I don't know. I don't know if that's particularly productive, because I think in some instances, because of the way the world is and because of how dangerous it can be for people in the public eye if they make mistakes or they make errors of judgment, I think it's a very good way to grow up in a lot of ways. There's a lot of responsibility there that that players of a different era didn't necessarily have. So you can't, for instance, you know, you're not going to get away with going for drinks after after a game. You're not going to, because there's going to be someone there with a camera and a Twitter account. So I don't know. And also, listen, I mean, a lot of these players are quite expressive in their playing style. I would be very wary, without, you know, being sort of doing the kind of COD psychology routine, I'd be very wary of curbing anything about their personalities at the moment, because this is what's working. Adrian's just quoted an incredibly impressive list of statistics which attest to this. They're being allowed to be, if that makes sense. And that seems to be the essence of their success.
He's got a perfect role model as well in Marcus Rashford, someone that has been allowed, has been trusted. He's been trusted to be himself, and being himself as well, he's done himself, his family, the club proud, the country proud. And yeah, he's got someone to look up to there. Giggs, he did the same, something similar with the class of 92. He was the year above them, of course, but he was the one propelled into the first team much, much sooner than the likes of Beckham and Scholes and whatnot. And he was there then, you know, lived properly, I think, especially in those young, you know, early days. And the players learned from him. And I think Seb touched on a very, very important point. The golden talents of years gone by had distractions, and you know, players behaved differently. There was always the temptation to go to, you know, turn to booze, so to speak, or get involved in gambling and whatnot. And I feel that the modern players, partly because of the way the academies are set up these days, with the way the clubs look after them from a very young age, and try and instill the right sort of values, I do feel, and the fact that social media is so prevalent, they know where the line is and what they can and can't do. I just feel that the modern footballer, the youngsters, live a very boring life, a very sensible life. And that ultimately, I think, is conducive to having more longevity at the top of the game, you know, barring injury, of course, which you can't always do too much about.
What strikes me is that the younger players that we're talking about, you know, let's be specific, Rashford, Raheem Sterling, two really good examples. They're very influenced by the way that prominent athletes in North America, you know, specifically in the NBA, are actually projecting themselves and using their platform in a positive manner. I suppose the danger is always going to be that the player or the young man regards himself as a brand rather than a footballer. And when you have that sort of superficiality around you and you judge yourself by other standards rather than the ones that you need to do and the stats that you were talking about, Aid, that's going to be the key, is basically concentrate on the game.
Well, it comes down to the individual, doesn't it? Ronaldo has, I mean, he's one of the most sort of sponsored athletes in history, yet he's always managed to prioritise the football, hasn't he? And that's the reason he's stayed so successful for so long. You can be a brand, but always make sure that the football comes first. It's pretty simple. And a lot of that depends on you from within and obviously the people that you associate with most closely. Hopefully Greenwood and Foden and guys like Rashford and Sterling have got the right people to advise.
Yeah. What about the value of experience, Seb? Now, I'm thinking specifically here of Chelsea. Now, they're at Palace on Tuesday. It's been very striking that Willian has been exceptional over the last couple of games. Giroud pops up at the weekend. Even Zouma came in and was a decent stopgap at central defence. Do we sometimes underestimate the value of that experience?
I think so, but I think it's important to define what we mean there, because there's different types of experience, aren't there? There's the kind which it just relates to a player who has made 300, 400 appearances versus the player that has actually experienced useful scenarios which he's able to relate to teammates in his career. Now, I think kind of the commodity that you have to value is the winner in the team. Now, the one that I always go back to actually is Esteban Cambiaso at Leicester City. Player comes in, has a fantastic attitude, doesn't have airs and graces, but just sets an example quietly. I'm not a great believer in just experience for experience sake. I believe in talent. I believe in ability. I believe in goal scoring, you know, making tackles, headers, that kind of thing. So the sort of the more literal elements in the game. But I think when you have a case like Chelsea, when your framework is essentially based on a lot of young players, which is going to increase because Werner is still a young player. Ziyech is not young, but he's not someone that has experienced something like the Premier League before. I mean, he's played in a second tier league all of his career up until now. So you have to have the right balance of personality, and probably personality is the word that I use over experience. I think you've got to have players in any team who know the route between minute zero and minute 90 in terms of how you win, how you encounter the peaks and the troughs of a game. So actually, what's interesting, we began this pod by talking about Tottenham. Now, you've got a lot of players there who have a lot of experience, who've got a lot of games under their belt, who have played in the Champions League, the Premier League, FA Cup, everything, international football, World Cups. And yet their response to certain situations, VAR, for instance, Jose Mourinho mentioned this, is absolutely dreadful. So it's not just the experience, it's the type of personality which goes with that experience which really matters.
I get the impression very much that character will be central to Frank Lampard's recruitment policy as well. You know, he, as an individual, he's got, you know, very strong values, I feel. Let's look at Pulisic. Is the challenge to keep him fit or just to keep him confident?
Well, definitely both. I mean, when Pulisic is confident, then he is a heck of an asset for Chelsea. No question about that. He's so sharp, isn't he, at the moment? Just lightning on those transitions. He's beating players at real speed. There's no hesitation in his play. So, no, they've got themselves a good player there. He looks like he might provide good value for money over a period of years. Chelsea have got a lot of strength, haven't they? Right across their midfield. You've got to say, through central midfield, where you've got, you know, younger players like Mount and Gilmore, coupled with Conte, Jorginho, Kovacic, the list goes on, Barkley. And then out wide, we've already mentioned Willian and Pulisic. You've got Hudson-Odoi. Loftus-Cheek can do that. Ziyech is coming in. It is scary. It's really at the top and back of the side where Chelsea need to focus their attention now. They need to get a better centre back, get a dominant goalkeeper, and they've sorted out the top end of the pitch with Timo Werner, haven't they? So really, it is just at the rear end where Frank needs to focus. And yeah, I do think that he will look towards personality. Interesting, wasn't it, to see him linked heavily today, I believe it was, with Declan Rice again. Sees him as a future centre-half in the John Terry mould. Obviously, we spoke about him the other day. I do think that he has potential to be successful as a centre-half or a central midfielder in a top side. Declan Rice, and he's definitely a player of character, and we know that he's best buddies with Mason Mount. We know he's a good lad, Declan Rice, and I think that will go a long way in regards to Frank Lampard's thinking. I'm getting to the point where I'd actually be surprised if Lampard doesn't make a substantial bid for Declan Rice.
Mm. Do you think that Chelsea will keep their place in the top four?
Ooh, I mean, if you'd asked me 3 weeks ago, I'd say definitely yes. But all of a sudden, Leicester have recovered. Manchester United look absolutely red hot. I think it's going to be one of the situations where it's going to depend on the cast judgment, which comes down in a week today. If fifth place becomes a Champions League qualifying position, then yes, I'd say so. If not, it's going to become really, really tight over the last few weeks. So, Chelsea probably the one that I have the doubts over, just because they're too reliant on a narrow group of players. So Giroud is still far too important to them. Willian is still far too important. Not because these aren't good players, it's just because these are players right at the end of the cycle. And it kind of relates to what we've just spoken about, is do we trust some of these young players not to express their ability, but to show their ability at absolutely the right moment? I'm not quite sure I'm at that stage with them yet.
If you're looking at the top four, probably Leicester at Arsenal on Tuesday is a pivotal game. You know, obviously, you follow Arsenal very closely, Aid. If you look at that, what is it, four wins on the bounce, three in a week, what has changed at Arsenal since that Brighton fiasco?
They changed the formation, which is important. It's a 3-4-3 at the moment, but in certain matches that will be tweaked. He's got different nuances to it, and that's part of the reason, because I think he realised that he can't really trust David Luiz or Shkodran Mustafi in a back four. So having that third defender gives him more confidence than the team. And actually, it frees up players ahead of them as well. At Wolves, for example, you had Kolasinac and Tierney. Well, Saka was in the team, so three left-backs. But Kolasinac and Tierney were able to cover off the left-hand side with Aubameyang, then basically allowed to stay on the halfway line, ready for breakaways, because there was that security. And this is against the Wolves team. They've got Doherty and Traore, who are sensational down that flank. So the new shape suits Aubameyang for sure. And I do think, and I think this is where you're getting at, is the Guendouzi situation, the Ozil players that are not involved at the moment, even though we think they're fit and available. I feel that he's made a big deal of discipline and trust. Who can I trust? Can I trust you or not? Can I look you in the eye? And if I give you instructions, will you follow them? And over the course of the last four games in all competitions, his players have delivered for him. They've really been disciplined on the pitch. And as a consequence, the standards have risen across the board. You know, everything that Arsenal are doing right now is much more professional. It's less, you know, it's less off the cuffness. It's a bit more structured to it. And yeah, it does stem, I think, from a real tough line or a hard line stance with Guendouzi, as if to say, look, if you're going to behave or misbehave there, and I don't feel I can trust you to stay on the pitch because you're going to lose your head, then you're not going to be involved. And I think that message has struck home to the other players. And also, why you got me? I think that his faith in the kids is really beginning to impact the side. Those players are feeling so at home under this manager. And it's freshened up the team, no end. I mean, Nketiah, Willock, Saka, they're all, every game, they're making a difference for Arsenal. It's really, really positive. I think he's doing a terrific job, really do.
Hey, do you think Guendouzi has to be sort of a sacrifice here, just for the sake of setting an example about what an Arsenal player is going to be going forward?
Yeah, quite possibly. I think that one of the first things he said in his press conference when he was unveiled as the manager was about standards on and off the pitch, about you know, he wants good people. And I'm not saying Guendouzi is not a good person. I'm not saying that. But in a football environment, you need players you can trust and that are reliable. And yes, I do think he's made an example of him. And if that means selling him to invest in others, I don't think he'd be afraid to do it. You were talking earlier, just a few minutes ago, about personality of players being so, so important. It is. And one thing that I've noticed in the last few games as well, and again, I'm not pinning this on Guendouzi or Ozil, but the group seem very much as a collective, and there is a you're seeing players talking to each other more often in these drinks breaks, which really should be renamed tactical breaks. You're seeing real concentration from groups of players that I wasn't seeing before. It's I think sometimes no matter how good a player is, sometimes you have to move them on if they're not the right fit for the overall dressing room, because one disruptive influence can topple everything, unfortunately, inside a football dressing room. So I do see maybe a change being made there.
Yeah, because one of the essences of coaching is communication. And what struck me, on the big picture level, Guendouzi is being used to transmit a message, a managerial statement. It's interesting, very good scout, Miguel Rios, who is working now in the sort of data area, he made a really interesting observation at the weekend looking at Arteta. He said that Arteta didn't stop talking to Dani Ceballos throughout it all. And there was that, it was interesting, you also said there, Aid, about the photographs. There was a really interesting photograph taken in one of those drinks breaks where the defence and Aubameyang was behind them, and they were absolutely lasered into what Arteta was telling them. There was no, I'll have a drink of water or I'll turn around and do my thing. They were absolutely into the manager, and I thought that was a really important sign.
And results like the one they achieved at Wolves, let's face it, Wolves, one of the most informed teams in the league, very hard to break down. Results like that will just only intensify the player's belief in the manager and his ideas. So, I do think that they're on board with his messages. But you do need results to maintain that level to some degree. Footballers, they want to work with progressive coaches. They want to work with people that they think can improve them. So I think there'll be a real desire to impress him between now and the end of the season. It's funny how things turn around quickly. It's only four games. There's so much more work to be done, but I do think that the basics of defending, of discipline, of shape, of structure, they are sinking in now. And when you've got the talent that Arsenal have in certain areas of the pitch going forward, that's a decent recipe. That's a good place to start the rebuild. So Arteta is looking like a better choice with every week that passes, in my opinion. And I would still say that if they were to lose the next game, even the next two games, he is a good appointment.
What do you make of Leicester, Seb? They probably needed to get Vardy firing again. Was it 101 goals now, isn't it? And 205 appearances. Tielemans compensated for some of their weaknesses, I thought, at the weekend. What about Maddison? He's not really been at the races, is he?
No, I think we've been a little bit early with the anointing oil with Maddison. Nice player, attractive footballer to watch, neat and tidy on the ball.
Where can I get my hands on this anointing oil? That sounds fantastic.
I'm not sure, and I'm willing to take the social media pelters for saying this. I'm not sure he's that good. I mean, I think he's quite a good footballer. I think he's somewhere between a 7 and 8 out of 10. I just think it's one of those situations where we've been a little bit knee-jerk with him because he's English and because he plays the game in a certain way. I'm a little bit concerned by the general standard of his performance against really good sides. Now, this is a kind of a team failing as much as it is an individual one, but my Leicester this season, when they've been up against Chelsea, Manchester City, Manchester United, they have not let themselves down. I think that's a little bit harsh, but they fail to deliver. They fail to do themselves justice. When we think of that as a theme, Maddison is the player I think of because they have huge issues in midfield. They almost depend on their centre-halves, especially against a side like Manchester City or Manchester United, against Chelsea. It's a worry because you wonder whether Brendan Rodgers has the ability to, because this team is based on this kind of nucleus of young players who are all at the same stage of their career,
It's going to depend on a little bit of a quantum leap if they can become the kind of side that can routinely win that sort of game. I don't know. I'm not as sold on them as I am, as everyone else seems to be, and that includes Maddison. I just don't. Is he a bit fair weather? That might be a really unkind thing to say, but that's what I think of him.
Let's look at Wolves, if we could, Aid. They're at Sheffield United on Wednesday. What were the lessons of their defeat by Arsenal?
Good question. I think it was a very mechanical performance. They looked flat. I think energy levels were definitely down. And Arsenal basically did a job on them. They matched them up formation-wise. They squeezed Adama Traore very well, closed down the wing-back. So as soon as those long... So what they did, they pressurised Connor Cody, who we know loves to drill those long diagonals to the full-back, to the wing-backs. And from there, Wolves can destroy teams. What they did was press Cody, whose passing wasn't then as good, to the wings. And then while the ball was in the air, their wing-backs, who are effectively in direct duels with the Wolves' numbers, they got touch tight and forced them to go backwards and sideways. And it just slowed down the Wolves' play. That is my one criticism of Wolves. And I think Nuno's a brilliant coach. They can be mechanical at times. And I don't think there's, aside from the glorious brilliance of Adama Traore, and at times Jota and Neto when they come on, I think that they lack a little bit of improvisation, and that I think is their weakness. They're also obviously slow starters, we know that. Rock bottom, by the way, I don't know if you know this, rock bottom of the half-time league. I know that there's absolutely no medals given out for being champion of the half-time league, but Wolves are bottom. No team has accrued fewer points in the first half of matches than Wolves. So, that is a glaring weakness they need to improve on. But yeah, for me, it was just a little bit too robotic, too mechanical. And what he did, he fell into the trap, Nuno, in this game. He fell into the trap that a lot of managers do when they're chasing. He chucked on everyone he could think of that was a forward player. And then the structure that Wolves are all about structure, the structure just completely went. And he had Neto, Jota, Traore and Jimenez on the pitch at once, and no one knew where to go. No one knew which runs to make. It was an absolute mess, actually, from a forward perspective towards the end. So lessons to be learned. I do expect them to respond against Sheffield United, because that was below par for them.
Lest we forget, they've only used 20 players, haven't they, in the league this season. Mm. So is that lack of depth going to be decisive, you know, in the short term at least? Because if you look at it, there will need to be recruitment in the summer, or what passes as a summer.
Yeah, I mean, it's a balance though, Mike, isn't it? Because, I mean, obviously it's quite a small squad compared with the rest of the Premier League, but what do we associate with Wolves and Nuno? It's cohesion. Adrian's described it as robotic and mechanical, and I don't disagree, but their meal ticket has been that cohesion, that tactical understanding. So when you start adding to a squad, you've got to make sure that the thing you're not sacrificing is the thing that has brought you to this point. Recruitment, I think Wolves have done a really good job of recruitment. We talked about Neto was one of those players that when he arrived and you saw who his agent was, you thought, oh, hello, okay, you're going to be parked and you're going to be bounced out somewhere else for profit. Actually, he's a really, really good player. That's kind of been the mold of the Mendes sort of whatever, however you term his involvement at Wolves. This has been a theme of players that have come in, have been integrated really nicely and have actually not just found positions, but found roles within the side. So I've got a lot of faith in them. Also, like, there are players there that we haven't seen the best of yet and who are still maturing. Someone like Mats Kilman is really interesting, like former futsal player. And, you know, I want to see his involvement as they get the opportunity to kind of integrate him full-time into a defence. I don't want to see them go silly. I mean, I you don't want to see them starting to sort of march an army of sort of 30, 40 million pound players through the door just for the sake of providing volume to the squad. It's got to be in the right measures.
But recruitment, you know, is always, you know, we say this almost every episode, don't we? It's absolutely key. And, you know, the players and their agents are playing their games yet again, aren't they, Age? If you think about it, Almiron and Saint-Maximin have a couple of good games and they're suddenly too good for Newcastle and they're being linked with Arsenal. You know,
yeah.
We're never going to get around that, are we?
Well, it depends. If this takeover goes through, then will they be good enough for Newcastle if they got the money to go and spend, I wonder. All I'll say on those two is that there has never been a better time for them to be at Newcastle, because maybe you noticed it before the pandemic and since, they've moved away from the back five. They've gone to a four-man defence, and they've ditched the defensive style. It's far more expansive now. They are playing with an attacking mindset. And hey presto, these two guys are getting onto the ball inside the opposition half and making a difference. They look outstanding, don't they? I think they're clearly two very talented players, but prior to the change in formation, they were getting about five touches apiece inside the opposition half, weren't they? And expected to to produce miracles. So if I was the agent of Almiron and St. Maximin right now, I'd be saying, keep doing what you're doing. Keep doing what you're doing, because finally we have a shape, a formation, an attitude within the team that suits you. So, they're a joy to watch. And actually...
How frustrating... Yeah,
go on.
Sorry, how frustrating is that? Because both, St. Maximin to a lesser degree, but Almiron has had quite a long bedding in period. And he's just started to find a kind of rhythm with some of the players there. On top of which, of course, we've got the takeover potentially going through at some point and a better standard of player approaching. So how short-sighted do you have to be to think this is the moment to abandon everything that's been worked for up to this point and to move on somewhere else and to start again? Because Almiron needs to feel comfortable, I think. He's not a good enough player just to be dropped in any side and to make a difference. He's a component. I know I've just butted in and ruined your line of thought there, but I think it's worth it because it's so frustrating.
No, definitely. He's so mindless to feel at home. And I think Almiron should absolutely stay put. St. Maximin, the excitement is there because of what Traore is delivering, I think. Because they are, obviously they're not the same, but there are similarities in the excitement that they produce. And I think that people are maybe elevating St. Maximin to a higher level than what they should at the moment, because that hat trick of assists the other day at Bournemouth was not the norm for him. I don't think he'd had very many assists at all prior to that. So I think if I was going to be looking into the market for a St. Maximin type player, as tempted as I would be, I'd want to see how he fares over a longer period in product wise before I started getting the old checkbook out.
But to use a very well-worn phrase, show me the money. That's always been the phrase in football, isn't it? Mm. And in that sense, Seb, what about the counter-attractions financially of the Bundesliga? Can you see, for instance, I can see the football logic of Jude Bellingham joining Borussia Dortmund, but what's he going to get, £54,000 a week at 17? That would blow my head off when I was 27, let alone 37 even. What about the finances of the German game? You know, you've got Leroy Sané going to Bayern. He's on $385,000 a week.
That was startling. In any other situation, it's what you'd expect of Bayern Munich. But, goodness me, given the conditions at the moment and given the uncertainty about the game's revenue stream, that is an awful lot of money. Wonderful player. I'm sad to see him leave because he was one of those players that was, yeah, so obviously great to watch on television, but an absolute joy in person to see Leroy Sané take on a defender. Bellingham, we've spoken about sort of the footballing advantages and the financial advantages, but I think one of the hidden benefits of him going there is he goes outside the goldfish bowl. Bellingham, to me, is one of the most unusual central midfield prospects I've seen in a really, really long time. I think he's an incredibly complete player for his age. And he is the classic example of someone who, if he was playing for an Everton, an Arsenal, a Spurs, whatever, the press would be all over him very, very quickly. The public would be all over him. He would be a star within the space of 6 months. I think going to Dortmund doesn't preclude that from happening, because as we've seen with Jadon Sancho, you can become very, very big very quickly because the game is global and everyone sees everything that happens in the Bundesliga in a way that they didn't 20 years ago. At the same time, I think it's an opportunity for him to grow slightly off stage. And I think that's important because I think he is, maybe Aid, you might be a better place to ask this. You're more over the Football League than I am, but he could be the best of the lot, I think, Bellingham, of this generation of players.
Well, he's certainly been the one who was talked about. I remember doing, when I was doing a book, speaking about him. And It was a bit Rooney-esque. It was always the name. You know, have you heard of Bellingham? And he was spoken of in whispers, and you know, he was good. He's got a very good family around him who have been shielding him. And I suppose, you know, we go back to what we were talking about with Mason Greenwood, isn't it? It's basically these kids have to have their feet on the ground because they're going to fly otherwise.
Yeah.
Do you think, just to sort of wrap this up, Aid, if I may, is there any theme here that we're talking about? Seb talked about, you know, a huge generation of players coming through, a lot of young players coming through. Mm. For your thought for the day, can you just give me an idea of what you think England's prospects are over the next 2 years?
Oh, so exciting. I think that the delay of Euro 2020 will enhance our chances of winning that competition next summer, because there are players that would have missed out this summer. I don't think Greenwood would have been in the squad. I don't think Foden would have been in the squad. You know, who knows what Bellingham can do between now and then as well. I think that as we sit here in 12 months' time, we could be basking in the glory of a really long run in the Euros, if not a triumph, because these young players are fearless and they are good enough. You're seeing them mix it at Premier League level in some very, very strong teams and look completely at home. It is. You don't like to label them golden generation, platinum generation, whatever tag, because that's all a bit cliched, but I don't think I've ever been as excited by a crop of players. These are the real deal. And crucially, they're guys that can impact the team at the top end of the pitch as well. These are creators, goal scorers, natural match winners. Southgate's going to have a lot of match winners at his disposal. The issue remains, where are the brilliant young central defenders? Where are the brilliant young fullbacks? Are they coming through? That's the one question mark. But yeah, it doesn't get much more exciting than this crop.
Okay. So, Seb, we began, you know, by subjecting you to the psychodrama of Mr. Mourinho. What would you like to finish with?
I'm still angry about a VAR issue, Mike. Sorry to
no, you're right, though. Pod. Yeah.
So the decision in the Sheffield United Tottenham game, the handball is the handball. I still haven't actually seen conclusive proof that it hit Lucas Moura's hand, but so be it. The clarity that I need is I want to know what happens to the offside rule in that situation, to the advantage rule in that situation, because the way it looked from that game is it appears as if neither Chris Kavanagh or Michael Oliver understands the procedure by which, if an advantage is going on at the point at which VAR intervenes, what happens to the restart? Now, the Premier League are really, really, really good at giving clarifications when they're right and when the laws support their stance. When they're wrong and when they don't have someone to throw under the bus, e.g. Hawkeye the other week, there's just deafening silence. And I think it's ridiculous because we now have this vagary within the rule. I don't know the law here, and that cannot be. So when a mistake is made, there has to be an ownership of that. So I want to know. So if an advantage is underway and VAR spots a handball and calls the play dead, how are we supposed to restart? Was this a mistake or is this a change that has been imposed on the game that we haven't heard about? It's a bizarre situation and it's a bit sad that like 5 days later I'm still going on about it.
I'm with you.
That's just about me being a boring person. That's not... But nevertheless, I still want to know the answer to this.
Yeah, no, I hear your pain.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to end with Liverpool. You know, we have not mentioned them so far, which is amazing when you think about it. Now, look, we all know that Jurgen Klopp's one of the good guys. He's emotionally engaged, he's empathetic, he understands football's place in everyday life. Yet the trademark smile masks a ruthless taskmaster and a seeker of the most marginal gains. I suppose what we're also beginning to understand is that he understands the human dynamics of professional sport. That's why he's promised to fund a Premier League winner's medal for each and every member of his squad, no matter what the rules say about a minimum number of appearances. Now, to me, that's a mark of mutual trust and respect and a reward for collective commitment. Because, look, the cause is identical whether you're an underemployed squad member or an ever-present star. Klopp practices what he preaches. Give me your all and I'll be there for you. Now, I play my heart out for him, wouldn't you? So, thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast, and stay safe.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.